Are you looking for a podcast that is the perfect blend of paranormal and pop culture?
Starting off with spooky stuff where we talk cryptids and ghosts.
And then we have our pop culture section where we sometimes have celebrity guests.
Whoa.
Yeah, do you want more?
Boy, howdy.
There's always genre news and all kinds of celebrity deaths. All kinds of it. If you're a celebrity and you die, we're going to talk about it.
I actually was hoping for UFOs.
Well, bet your ass we got that too at the end.
Earthling Entertainment. New episodes every Thursday.
Make sure to check us out anywhere you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Zombie Strains, the podcast that watches all the zombie movies. Today, a movie rooted in science.
If we are to preserve the patient until we can complete the synthetic heart transplant, there must be absolutely no cellular decomposition whatever.
Fortunately, John Carradine is here to clear all this up.
These are the receivers that will relay the knowledge from the memory retention cell into the brain of the transplant. You see, these are tuned to a pre-designated frequency cycle beamed from the transmitter.
That actually didn't help, John. Got any more?
We must feed this memory circuit through the emotional quotient rectifier to determine if there's any residual impurity.
That's right. It's 1968's The Astro Zombies.
No, I've seen people act like that in pictures. What do they call them? Zombies or something?
Zombies.
What's a zombie?
Just what is a zombie?
Well, a zombie, there's, Mr. Bill is...
The living dead.
They are the living dead.
Get into zombies.
He's a zombie.
Because a zombie has no will of his own.
It's an army of zombies. No armies could stand.
What is wrong? What is wrong?
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Zombie Strains. I'm John.
I'm Andy.
And I'm Brad.
Hey, did anybody else think of, immediately upon watching this movie, the band Astro Man from the early 90s? They were part of the surf music revival, like Shadowy Men on a Shadowy Planet.
I was going to mention this band made me dig up some White Zombie, the band, and listen to. I feel this is kind of in their general aesthetic.
Yes. No, it's an interesting movie, and I just couldn't stop thinking, Man or Astro Man is the band, and their album Destroy All Astro Men, and that just kept running through my brain. So today, we're back in the good old US of A with a very goofy science techno thriller. Producer Brad, how did The Astro Zombies come to be? And tell us about all these wonderful people that are in it.
First, I'd like to go to Andy's Grammar Corner.
Welcome to Andy's Grammar Corner.
Uh-oh.
Can you come into my Grammar Corner?
Well, I'm knocking at the door. I'm not barging in.
Okay.
Does this movie need a hyphen between Astro and Zombie?
I think it probably should have one, yes.
It looks weird to me.
I mean, do you think they should be two words or they should be one word?
Two words.
I think it should be two words.
I would put a hyphen. So I'm going to, I mean, this movie, it's very rigorous in its adherence to the laws of science and technology.
Yes.
So I want to give it the benefit of the doubt with its adherence to the laws of grammar as well.
All right. Good deal.
All right. Slippery answer. All right. Moving on. The Astro Zombies was released in May 1968. It's an independent American film released in the same year as 2001 A Space Odyssey, Rosemary's Baby, and Planet of the Apes.
Woof. Like, just can I pause there for a second? Like,
That hurts.
It does hurt. Like, 2001 A Space Odyssey is on the list for, like, potential greatest movies of all time. It's in the conversation, and here we are. With John Carradine in The Astro Zombies.
Well, and 2001 and Planet of the Apes are both known for groundbreaking special effects in 1968.
Yes, this movie, groundbreaking is not the term I would use. Special, maybe, but yeah.
Well, Astro Zombies was written, produced, and directed by Ted V. Michaels. This is the sixth film he directed. He went on to produce, write, direct, or finance over 100 movies. He claimed that is more than any other filmmaker who wasn't financed. Michaels never had a studio deal, and he cobbled together financing for each film. He lived in the low-budget world his entire career. We mentioned the 1965 film Orgy of the Dead in our Plan 9 from Outer Space episode.
Mm-hmm.
Orgy of the Dead was written by Ed Wood. Now, Michaels' friend, Stephen Apostoloff, directed and needed help on set, so Michael spent time teaching the cameraman how to do his job. That cameraman, Robert Caramico, went on to be a cinematographer on over hundreds of episodes for shows like The Waltons, Falcon Crest, Dallas, and Just Shoot Me.
Oh, all right.
Okay.
Also on his list here, there's a lot of things, and I'll let you keep going, but The Corpse Grinders, which you so gleefully mentioned an episode or two ago, was also on the list, and I can't remember the context. I might have been an actor, but that's not the first time that's come up either.
Yes. Michael directed his first film, Strike Me Deadly, in 1963, followed by Dr. Sex, The Black Klansman, and Girl in Gold Boots. He produced The Corpse Grinders and two upcoming zombie strain films, Children Shouldn't Play with Dead Things and The Worm Eaters.
Do you think that Dr. Sex is the movie where we finally would get the promised dynamic sex lectures that Maniac promised us back in the 30s?
If not, I'm very disappointed. Yeah, we were saying a couple episodes ago, like the line between horror and, you know, exploitation horror and pornography is getting thinner and thinner, and it's pretty thin in this movie. So,
yeah. Yeah, we're getting close. Michael's 1973 film, The Doll Squad, about beautiful female CIA agents, is considered an inspiration for both Charlie's Angels and the Deadly Viper Assassination Squad from Tarantino's Kill Bill.
Oh, all right.
The Astro Zombies had three sequels, all made by Michaels: Mark of the Astro Zombies in 2004, Astro Zombies M3 Cloned in 2010, and Astro Zombies M4 Invaders from Cyberspace in 2012.
2012?
Are we going to watch those later? I hope so.
Well, there's zombie in the title.
Yeah. All right.
Are these parodies? Are the sequels, like a sequel made in 2012, that has to have been like a tongue-in-cheek thing, right?
I haven't seen them, but there's an interview with him where he said once he found out he could shoot on videotape, he started doing that because he could move faster.
Oh, no.
And the tape he used was Beta SP, which was a professional level. But yeah, it's going to look
like Oprah, basically.
Oh, yeah. I think Oprah's going to look better.
Incredible.
There's much more about Michaels. He was a big character, but he's going to come back for a couple more episodes for us. I'll talk more about him then.
Okay.
The Astro Zombies was co-written by Wayne Rogers. Rogers was an actor and had seen Strike Me Deadly and wanted to work with Michaels. They wrote and produced the 1964 film Dr. Sex. They followed that with The Astro Zombies. Does the name Wayne Rogers ring a bell?
It does, but I feel like I'm just concatenating two other famous people. So who is Wayne Rogers?
He played Trapper John on the first three seasons of MASH.
Oh, whoa. My God. Yes.
Now, Rogers was friends with the actor Peter Falk. He was Columbo, and they used Falk's house as a location for many scenes in this film.
Oh.
Peter Falk also shot a cameo, but Michaels cut it because he thought it was too funny and didn't fit the tone of the film.
Okay, that's...
Yeah,
he
was intentionally rich. Funny, and this film is just unintentionally funny.
Now, Gary Hecock was in charge of the special effects. We first encountered him on Dr. Terror's Gallery of Horror, which he wrote. So he went into special effects, so this is one of the films.
Oh, okay.
Onto the cast. Top billing went to Wendell Corey, who plays Holman, the CIA boss. Corey,
no relation. Sorry to disappoint everybody.
You just say that, but we haven't done the due diligence, so we'll spend some time on that. Because you might find out you want to be related to him.
Maybe. He died the same year this movie came out. That's a little unsettling. Yeah.
Corey was a character actor most of his career. He's best known as Detective Doyle in Rear Window. Doyle was friends with Jimmy Stewart's character. He was also president of the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences from 1961 to 63.
Oh, wow.
John Carradine played Dr. DeMarco, the mad scientist, and one of the villains. Carradine has acted in more zombie films that we have watched than any other actor. This is his fifth film, his first being 1943's Revenge of the Zombies,
which is a classic. And I recall, I was thinking about this, my recollection is when we were doing our end of season one Hall of Fame, like we nominated him, but I said, no, he had to do more to get in. And I think he's got to be in after season.
What more could he do to earn a place?
Yeah, now it's undeniable.
I would argue after this film, could he do a little less? There's a lot of spinning of dials in this film. And just as a reminder, John Carradine, one of his first big roles was in The Grapes of Wrath.
That's right.
The John Ford classic. And there's a review, I'm sorry, I don't remember which one, for Astro Zombies. And the guy wrote, and it looks like he aged 92 years between The Grapes of Wrath and this film.
Poor John. Like clearly he lived hard and just had to keep working to keep his lifestyle going. But we love you, John.
I was reading up on John Carradine after watching this movie, and he was in a movie. I discovered a subgenre that I am super intrigued by. He was in a movie called Billy the Kid versus Dracula, I think. Mm-hmm. And it was released as a double feature with Jesse James Meets Frankenstein's Daughter.
Oh, this sounds like our next podcast or bonus content for this one.
I know. Wild West Outlaws that meet Hollywood movie monsters.
I'm here for that.
Yeah. All right. Carry on.
Well, that means you have to see The Wild West with Will Smith.
Oh.
Okay.
That might put an end to your aspirations. Tura Satana plays Satana, the foreign agent trying to obtain DeMarco's discovery. Her first film role was a small part in Billy Wilder's Irma LaDuce. Her most famous role is in the Russ Meyer's film Faster Pussycat Kill Kill. John, as a reminder, that's the Russ Meyer film.
Yeah. Okay. Can I just her name is Tura Satana, like that's her real name?
Yes.
And the name of her character in this movie?
Yes.
Like, talk about being born to play a role. Goodness grace.
She played Varla, leader of the gang of go-go dancers. She was also one of the agents in Michael's film, The Doll Squad, which I should mention, not only was it an inspiration for Charlie's Angels, but it's also considered one of the first jiggle fests.
Okay.
That's a genre I'm not going to Google.
Yeah, I would like to say I think she was excellent in this film, but generally speaking, I feel the women were cast for something other than their acting talents in general.
Satana will return to the Astro Zombie universe for the second and third films.
She was in Our Man Flint. Isn't that like a good regular movie?
She had a unique look and got cast in some cool things.
She did. Yeah, and she's like 8 feet tall as well.
Yeah. William Bagdad played Francho, Dr. DeMarco's assistant. He was in the Monkees TV show as a henchman to a king, and also in the Monkees movie Head, playing a black sheik.
I'm trying to figure out how a king and a sheik appeared in the Monkees show, but
that's what I get
for not watching it.
You've never seen the Monkees?
Well, I mean, I might have seen a couple when I was young. My mom liked the Monkees, so it was kind of a thing, but I don't know. I don't remember it.
I don't think you could watch the Monkees today. I think it would be too...
Oh, I think you could watch. I mean, as long as you keep in mind the word zany, then you're fine.
Yes. Yes.
The rest of the cast were minor character actors with small parts on TV shows. Many worked often with Michaels on his other films. Victor Ize, who played Dr. Petrovich in Astro Zombies, was Dr. Sex in the movie Dr. Sex. And we will see many of them again when we make it to the 70s. The last thing I'd like to bring up is the Misfits, the punk band from the 80s, had a song called Astro Zombies that they released in 1982.
That's excellent. And very, it's a very punk thing to do, is find an obscure movie from the 60s and write a song about it.
Now, the New York Times stated in Michael's obituary that the Astro Zombies went on to make $3 million against a budget of $37,000. So this movie made some money.
It sounded like you were going to say $37. And I was thinking, yeah, that's probably.
And I would have been okay with that too. Yeah. All right. Well, that's a lot. Good job, producer Brad. So, Andy, it's 1968, time of great movies. We haven't seen them, but we hear that. And is there any historical context you want to give us for 1968? I mean, it's a big year generally, but.
Yeah, it's a huge year. I'll keep this brief because I've gone on some long tangents in this segment in past episodes. But 1968, huge year, way more than we can kind of quickly sum up. But so this movie is about space. It's about computers, and it's about advanced medical concepts and practices.
Yeah, they're talking about like the concept before the astro creature becomes a zombie is that humans can be modified to make them more suited for space travel.
Yeah, which is like not the worst idea.
It's kind of advanced. They talk about they're going to inject their skin with a silicone something so they're resistant to micrometeorites. It's like, wow, there's actually some thought about technology in this, strangely.
Yes. And so those areas were all areas that in 1968 were sort of taking giant leaps forward in medicine. this was the year of the first successful adult human heart transplant. And we've talked about the rapid advance of, I guess, transplant technology in past episodes, but that's still very exciting and cutting edge stuff.
And our hero, John Carradine, has a heart in a box that he keeps alive. So that's good.
Yes. He keeps rubbing it.
He keeps like petting his heart. His heart in
maybe
a box.
That's what they actually did in 1960.
Who knows?
We don't. Were you there, John?
I was not.
Okay. So computers are also play a central role in this movie. I don't know enough about the terminology to relate this correctly, but a lot is going on as far as the birth of modern computing in 1968.
The technobabble in this movie is next level. Like, you heard some of it in our intro, but John Carradine talks about degaussing and like everything. Like, he's, yeah.
Yes. And we watch a 17-minute degaussing scene, if I recall correctly. Yeah. But, okay, one last thing. So, yeah, this is a big year for computing. The company that will become known as Intel was formed this year. And lastly, there's a lot of space stuff goes on in 1968. Probably this movie came out before this happened, but this is the year we orbited humans around the moon.
Yep.
And there were some other space discoveries were happening, like we discovered pulsars this year. And so space was definitely in the air, even if it was towards the end of 1968. That the really exciting stuff like Apollo 7 and stuff happened.
Yeah, you know, I was born a year after this movie came out. You guys can do your own math. But this was the time of the most exciting space exploration, in my opinion, because not only did we land on the moon, we then had Skylab, and then we sent out probes to the distant solar system. And I think, if you don't know, when I was a kid in the 70s, it was the first time we actually had a photograph of Neptune that you could look at. Like, nobody had, we had theoretical ideas about these far planets and what they were like, but we had never sent probes to them or photographed them or anything. And so, you know, it was an exciting time to be a kid because this was all brand new, you know.
I remember, I'm a couple years younger than you, John, but I remember how exciting it was. Like, our family had a couple of books of basically space photography.
Oh my gosh.
And it was so new and so exciting and thrilling to flip through those photos.
I still have my Carl Sagan Cosmos book, which is filled with pictures like that. I still adore it, even though they've been outpaced by the Hubble Space Telescope and everything.
So that's what I got for historical context. Hopefully, you know, this movie really rewards your interest in space computers and technology,
yeah.
with a deep exploration of those themes.
Yeah, good luck. I'd just like to say, so 1968, we're not ignoring it. It's just that's also the year Night of the Living Dead comes out, and we will be doing a deeper dive. Like, we've talked about a little bit, but we will be revisiting the counterculture in 1968 and why that's such a big year in a couple of episodes. So don't worry. We'll get there. Thanks for that, Andy. And while you're at it, do you want to give us... I challenge you to give us a summary of this film.
I will do my very best. Tell me how I do. All right. So The Astro Zombies is the story of mad scientist Dr. DeMarco, played by John Carradine. DeMarco was dismissed in disgrace from an aerospace research facility, but do you think he stopped his unethical research, John?
Well, spoiler, no, he hasn't.
He did not. So he's been out there pursuing his dream of creating what he calls a quasi-man, an astro-zombie. This is an artificially created human built out of the parts of other people, a sort of golem type of creature. The original intent was this creature could be sort of remotely controlled from a computer,
right,
and sent into hostile environments like space. But alas... it didn't work out quite so well, or he's got some kinks to work out because one of his astro zombies has escaped. It's going on a murder spree around Los Angeles. And so our heroes are some detectives and some hangers-on trying to solve the crimes committed by the astro zombies. At the same time, a sinister trio of villains led by Satana is trying to track down
Dr. DeMarco for their own nefarious purposes. They want his research for themselves. So who will reach Dr. DeMarco first, our heroes or Satana and her thugs? I guess you'll have to stay tuned to find out.
Yeah, we're not going to spoil that right now. That was a great summary on what I think is an overly complicated plot. Yes. Yeah, there's characters that come and go. So I'm going to try to navigate that. Like, we kind of skipped the plot last time. We'll probably get a little bit more into it this time because it's a little more fun.
Yep. To, sounds good.
To mess around with it. All right. Well, let's.
All right. Take it away, John.
Yeah. So let's start. Like, we open on a woman driving, playing swinging 60s music.
Yeah. The music actually really jumped out at me. This isn't the first movie that's had contemporary music in it, but this was like very 60s sounding music.
Yes. And so when I was saying, that the line between pornography and horror, this is where those merge most strongly, if they were ever really separate. I think we've just gotten a little more risque. So this woman is driving her 1966 Mustang convertible into her garage. She has no lines, but she has very large breasts, which is why she's in this movie. And she's going to get killed slasher style by an astro zombie who has for some reason been hiding in her garage. There's a splatter of blood across the side of her Mustang. The blood is incredibly orange and looks just like paint. And there's so much going on in the beginning. I want to pause here to see if you would like to say anything about the scene before we get into the credits sequence, Andy.
A couple things. First, this movie made me nostalgic for garage doors that like swing open instead of roll open.
Yes.
So I don't know when rolling garage door technology was invented.
My
uncle had a garage door company. I'll have to ask him for you.
You should ask him.
Let me ping him right now. Hold on.
Yeah. We should have had him on as a guest for this.
Yeah,
episode.
Come on, Brad. No, I had one like that maybe in the late 80s, early 80s. It was we lived in a condo and we had a garage door like that.
I also noted how orange the blood is. I mean, it's such an important part of a horror movie. Why not just take a minute and realize you have the wrong color and try and tweak it?
Yeah,
you know?
If I could say there was a sort of guiding filmmaking philosophy to this film, it's good enough. Like,
well, the only other thing I want to note is just how horror movie this kill is.
Yes, and we haven't seen one quite like it. Like, I can't say this is the first horror movie to do it. I think other ones are doing it, but definitely it's new for us.
It is, and it's edgy. It felt a little edgy. It doesn't show the woman gets stabbed to death with, I think, like a gardening tool,
like a
right?
gardening claw.
Yeah,
yeah.
But her death is kind of prolonged. He stabs her a bunch of times as she screams, and we see blood splash. And it just felt like something more out of a slasher movie.
Yeah, and they do this a couple times in this film, and it's the classic. Either you can see the silhouette or you can see the weapon move up and down and see the splash of blood, but you don't actually see the impact. So,
yeah,
it's very slasher style.
And I guess the last thing, not to drag this out, I know we got to get rolling, but
no, this is important.
We do get a look at our zombie in its opening 90 seconds. So,
yeah, can we talk about
this? It's a quick one. You want to tell us what the zombie looks like?
So if John Carradine was trying to be subtle in his design of the Astro Zombie, he has failed. Because what he looks like, he's wearing a skull mask with giant eye holes and like electrodes and stuff protruding from it. And instead of a mouth, there's like a wire mesh grill. And it looks like a skull head. He looks like Skeletor without the glowing eyes, right? Like,
I'm trying to imagine this being rolled out to the public.
Yes.
You know, it's just a little hard to picture.
See our new astronauts. Yeah. Like, how's that going to work? Yeah. So, yes, we do see him. There's no motivation for the killing. We do get to find out kind of why.
I look forward to learning that because I couldn't tell you why.
I clipped part of it. Yeah. Here. So what's interesting about this movie is we move from scene to scene. We have like four different groups of actors here, right? We've got the detectives. We've got Dr. DeMarco, played by John Carradine, and his Igor assistant.
Yeah.
Francho. And then we've got Satana and her thugs. And then we've got, who's the fourth? There's another group.
Bowman and the CIA.
And the CIA, right. So we just cut from those groups and we'll do like 10 minutes with a group and then cut to the other group and do 10 minutes with them. And the other thing about this movie is everything, it's like, I put in my notes, and this is maybe misleading, it feels like Plan 9 from Outer Space in some ways. It's not that bad, But what I've learned about bad movies is, and bad directors in particular, is when they're I'm sorry to use this phrase, please excuse me, crafting a narrative, what they're doing, everything is so mannered. Like, they don't know that you don't have to show Francho, you know, we're about to get to a scene with a crashed car. We don't need to know that he comes up to the car. He comes up slowly to make sure nobody's watching. He pulls the body out of the car. He drags the body. Like, everything is in sequence, and every action is shown in full. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
this movie could have been a half hour shorter just with some quicker cuts. Like, you know. So anyway, that's this movie in a nutshell. So it is a little on the boring side.
You just got excited by that degaussing scene where we watch him unscrew like 7 screws from a
Riveting.
Oh.
Okay. Anyway,
we do have credits, and I want to talk about the credits because I was delighted by them.
I wrote the credits are wild. Do you want to describe these delightful credits, Andy?
Yes. So the credits show us a scene of a bunch of toy wind-up robots and a remote-controlled toy tank battling each other while you hear real battlefield noises and explosions in the background. And just to give you a sense of the sort of movie this was, I truly did not know if this was supposed to be a bunch of toys or if I was looking at something the movie wanted me to take seriously.
Well, you know what? I'm still not sure.
So. I'm not sure either.
By the way, the tank is similar to a M36 Pershing tank from late in the Second World War, in case you're wondering.
Okay. And what model were the robots, please? The robots?
I don't know, because there were no real robots then.
Oh.
Those are just toys. No, but they're like the classic block-headed, like, people who are younger won't remember these. You got these little plastic, they were metal, actually, robots, and they would have like little lights on their chests and stuff. And none of their parts would move, but they had like wheels in their feet. Their feet looked like, they looked kind of like the robot from Lost in Space, but instead of a glass head, like a square block head.
Yeah.
And then it had little wheels on the bottom, and it would roll along the pavement for about 3 inches before it fell over because it was so top heavy. I didn't have one. I think one of my friends had one, but yeah, these were a thing.
So yeah, I imagine this was an attempt to be cheeky and funny, although I don't entirely understand.
Yeah, I don't either, but let's just appreciate it for what it was.
Yeah.
Yeah. However, the action continues. Now, when I say a car crash, what I mean is we come up on a crashed car. Like, it's just there, and there's a man inside the car dying. We don't know where it is. We don't see it happening. It just, and then this
guy.
We don't even see a road.
It's just like in a field somewhere.
Yeah, and of course, there's more orange blood, but there's nobody to come rescue him. Who comes out is who we'll learn later, is this sort of hunchback lab assistant to Dr. DeMarco. His name is Francho. Which I didn't make sense, but when you spelled it, Brad, it's C-H-O-T. So I think it's supposed to be French, like Francho.
Sure, sure.
I'm trying.
I really like the idea that the writers were like, we need this character to seem like he's French, like Francho.
Otherworldly. Yes.
Yeah.
So he's from somewhere else.
Well, I think what's interesting is that all the villains in this movie are, quote unquote, foreigners. They're not American. So we can get into that when we get there. But anyway, this is a 1964 Studebaker Gran Turismo that has been smashed. And in this long, you know, I gave that lecture about how everything is mannered, because it takes Igor Francho, it feels like an hour to just get the body away and drag him back to the lab. Like, you know what I mean? Like, they show every action he takes. And then the dramatic thing is that when he's dragging the body, one of the shoes comes off and the camera zooms in on the shoe. And then we cut to another car. Like, so we still don't know what's going on, right? We're switching to another context. There's some blonde man in the back of what turns out to be a 1960 Cadillac sedan DeVille, simply watching a tape rewind, and like we cut back and forth from his face to the tape a couple dozen times, and then the tape rewinds and he puts it in his pocket. This is a reel-to-reel tape for those.
Did anyone else pause it here and Google Maps where he was?
No. Did you recognize it, Brad? Because there's a Los Angeles freeway sign, and I didn't make a note of it. But
Actually, I did. I think I'm not 100% certain, but it looked like it was the. I actually froze the frame to see the sign. I couldn't read it, but it's a big exchange, and I think it might be on the 5 somewhere on the east side.
All right,
it is. It's on the 5 near Riverside Drive, exit for Riverside Drive,
nice.
Which is near Dodger Stadium, I think.
Which is a half mile from me right now.
Oh,
well, I awesome. Just got chills. Wow.
All right, so we're going to switch context again. That's it. That's all that happens. We just see this blonde guy with a tape.
So I will say that blonde guy gives off spy vibes, I think.
Yes, like foreign spy vibes. Let's be clear.
Yeah.
All right, so we're like 8 minutes into the movie. We haven't learned a character's name. We don't know anything. And now we actually get to the exposition dump, right? Like, I had trouble choosing clips. I chose two clips from this next scene. Because there was so much exposition, and I changed my mind like 3 times. I'm like, do I want these two? Do I want these two? So anyway, they go into a spot. Like, who are these people, Andy? They're like, they work for the CIA. They're doctors, but they work for the CIA. Like, I don't quite know who
they are. I didn't really ever understand it. It's kind of like it's like the CIA or the police chief or something.
Well, you clearly know it's the government, because behind the police chief, behind the leader, the boss is... back, you see a picture of JFK.
No.
And then on the other side of the room, they have a picture of LBJ. They have both.
Thank you.
Okay. Yeah.
I almost panicked there.
Yeah, no. They had pictures of both. And I will note that one of the characters who's here, Dr. Porter, he looks like JFK. You know what I mean? He's got the hairstyle. He's like, if you put them next to each other, like he doesn't really, but that's what they're going for. You
but
know
he kind
I mean?
Of sounds like JFK with
he
that
He does
accent.
Have that little clipped accent. Yeah, but not quite. Like,
he doesn't nail it, but he's trying.
I don't know. I didn't feel like he quite had a JFK level of charisma, but you know, maybe you guys saw something in his performance.
No, just the hair is really what I'm responding to.
So this scene made me think, you see this, we've seen this in some other movies too. The reason the scene is so confusing is because there's like 9 people in this room.
Yeah.
You don't know their names. And like, so you're doing this movie on a low budget, I assume. Why does this scene need like 9 people? This is a 2-person scene.
I don't know. You remember we talked about Get Smart and like that scene with the cone of silence?
Yeah.
This scene has that scene's vibe. It's a bunch of people crowded in a room talking to each other, just throwing exposition at each other. Basically what they're speaking about, and we'll play a couple of clips here, is to say, you know, there's been this new invention. Dr. DeMarco was working on it, but he's left. But his partner, Dr. Petrovich, is still here working on it, and they talk about why this is important. And they also talk about these murders that were happening, which refers back to the very beginning of the film, which was the mutilation murders, which is a super original name for a murderer. So anyway, I'm not even going to try to describe the whole scene, but let me give you a couple of clips here. So this is the technology that they were pursuing, as described by the two doctors at the beginning here.
As you can see, I took the liberty of bringing in some of the experimental work from the lab. Now, you know Dr. DeMarco and the extent of his work better than anyone. I would like you to explain to Mr. Holman here the theories that you and Dr. DeMarco had developed on vital organ implants and thought wave transmission.
Right, so that's the tech here. And they have, so... they have,
and that's the guy who sounds like JFK.
That's the guy who sounds like JFK. They have like fake organs, but they also have a real brain in a jar here with some transistors hooked up to it, which is awesome.
I love the idea that the CIA set those up and then called the doctor in. It's like, you know, maybe the doctor would want to have a brain in a jar when we meet with him.
Yeah, like just in case he wants to show us anything. And they go through this thing where they're like, look, we're not really doctors. I mean, we are doctors, but we work for the CIA, and we had to infiltrate your lab to make sure you weren't involved somewhere with Dr. DeMarco. It's this long speech. And then Dr. Petrovich gives this long speech back. There's technobabble. They agitate the brain with sound waves. But here's the other clip I wanted to play, because it's actually crucial. So my namesake, Wendell Corey, whose character I have forgotten.
Holman.
But the young guy says the following line when they're describing why this would be good. Here's the response that they get from somebody they're trying to teach about this stuff.
Quasi-man? You mean a sort of a zombie?
Well, that's not exactly scientific terminology, but it would be close to the truth.
What else would you call a man with a synthetic electrically driven heart, a stainless steel mesh stomach, plastic pancreas, cellulose liver, and to mention a few things for a starter.
So, Andy, we haven't seen, well, we've seen our zombie. We haven't, you know, we haven't made the connection, but we've seen our murderous zombie with the skull mask in the garage at the beginning. And now you've heard this description of this zombie. What does this sound, let's say a sort of zombie, what does this sound like to you?
It sounds like Jason or something from Halloween is what it sounds like.
Yes.
but
somehow this is going to benefit humanity. And well, I think I the idea have, is that
what
because...
What are you getting at?
I think I'm so curious about this zombie because what they're saying is we're gonna make an artificial human that we can control so they can go to space safely, right? Like that's the plan.
Yeah.
And it goes awry. We're not sure quite sure why. But they wanted this research, but they decided Dr. DeMarco went too far. Like it's just very strange. But anyway, that's how they describe our zombie. It's in fact, when you ask the question later, what kind of zombie is this? It's a science-created artificial person zombie, remotely controlled, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
And there's, well, maybe you'll get into it, but there's a little bit more to Dr. DeMarco's dream that I thought was actually a little bit intriguing. I guess let's wait till we get to Dr. Marco's lab before we go into it. But
yeah, and you can tell me because I didn't really see it.
Okay. Well,
let's wait till we get to his lab because we got another scene. We're gonna get there. We've got another set. We got to switch contexts. We got two more context switches, and then we're gonna start rotating our context. So here's our next context
and rotating dials,
and rotating dials and rotating context. That describes this movie perfectly. So now our villains are gonna meet. So you remember the guy from the car that was rewinding the tape? He comes into a bar, and sitting there are the evil Satana and her sidekick, Juan. Juan is wearing a cravat, which I really respect. And he has like an 8-inch switchblade. And they go through this exchange where like the guy who stole the tape is negotiating for more money and they don't want to pay it. And Satana throws a drink in his face. And
Juan threatens him with his big knife. But he threatens him. Juan is like sitting in the booth.
Yeah.
Like he can't... He couldn't reach the person like, he's threatening with the
knife.
I'm
going to stab you. Like, yeah. Anyway, they have an exchange. Satana clearly does not like to be crossed and have somebody demand more money at the end of an assignment. So she nods her head to her other henchman, who is some vaguely Russian person with a scar on his face. And he goes out and he murders the man's driver, takes his Cadillac, and then when the man comes out and summons the car, he runs him over with it. But now our villains have the tape. We don't know what's on the tape, but we know the villains are villainous and they have a tape. Describe our villains a little bit here, because I mentioned earlier none of them are American. So who do we have here?
Yeah, well, we have kind of a motley crew of people who are kind of suggestively non-American, I would say.
Vaguely so, non-American, hand-wavy non-American. Yeah.
We've got the Russian one. We have Satana and two thugs. One of the thugs is kind of Russian, Eastern European. Juan is of indeterminate ethnicity, I would say. But Satana, I think they are trying to evoke a sort of, quote, Eastern menace vibe with her.
Yeah, I think with Juan, they're probably going for Cuba, right?
Cuba. Okay.
And also our blonde tape rewinder is German.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, so Satana is kind of set up as sort of a femme fatale isn't quite the right word, but she's sultry in every interaction she has. She's slinking around and
wears loose fitting clothing all the time. Revealing clothing.
So, but she was interesting, you know. I mean, this is a different kind of villain that we've seen than we've seen. So I'll give her that.
Yeah. And it comes to the sadistic villain that we haven't really seen too much of, but like when Brad mentioned the movie Faster Pussycat Kill Kill, like this is that kind of, we're starting to get into that mindlessly sadistic villain mode, and she's in that mode for sure.
Yeah, she feels a little bit like she transferred over from one of the less good James Bond movies.
Yes, exactly. Yep. And she's actually pretty good in this movie. Like, there's not a lot of great performances in this movie because it's pretty bad. She's pretty great in it. And
she's certainly the most memorable performance for sure.
Well, and one thing the director does, which is I find kind of awkward, is he lingers on their faces just so their eyes are darting around the actors.
Yes.
And so they're looking around with, and it's just like a close up of heads. And it's kind of,
it's
uncomfortable to watch.
It is. Again, it's so mannered. What are we waiting for? Right? Let's go. Move on. You know, so sometimes he does it when he wants to, you know, reveal, you know, do a sort of male gaze kind of shot on the women in the film, which he does endlessly. But then he also just does it in close-ups and stuff, too. So it's very, it's very awkward all around.
It doesn't help the actor's performance.
No.
Well, he does have something special in Satana's, like, face. Like, she's got a unique look. And it's a intense screen presence, I would say.
Yeah.
And so he does spend a lot of time just showing us shots of Satana's head, basically.
Yeah, staring at people. Kind of
stares at someone.
So we have another new context. This is sort of our last group. And we go to Dr. DeMarco's lab. We don't know that, and they don't actually say that, but you kind of can figure it out. So hunchback assistant, Francho, from earlier in the film, he brings the body he picked up, I don't know, 25 minutes ago, into this lab. And who's there but John Carradine, who is Dr. DeMarco. He's hard to describe as a villain, though he does start off with, he's sort of massaging a heart in a tank, which starts beating. And he starts spouting off all this technical stuff for Francho to do so they can... I don't know what. Like, this is where you could tell me, Andy, what his actual dream is. I have a clip here, and maybe we should do that. But
yeah, play the clip, and then I have a few thoughts.
Yeah, just to set up the lab for a second. It's pretty. It's like a dungeon. It's pretty lame. Like, they just didn't have enough budget to make it cool. But there's gurneys and beakers and stuff. But it looks like it's underground somewhere. In any case, you know, they're doing this, all these experiments and stuff. And anyway, here's. Let's hear John Carradine just sort of talk about what he's doing, and then tell me, Andy, what you took from this.
It is done, Francho. We will add this circuit to the memory bank until we can effect an exchange with the first Astro Man. One day we'll be able to fill the memory bank with the most brilliant minds in the world, preserved forever for the benefit of mankind, to call on them for their knowledge.
So is that it, Andy? Is that what his dream
is? That is it. And I thought that was pretty interesting.
It is interesting. I'm just not quite sure where it's coming from. So tell me what you think he's trying to do. I mean, he says it, but I don't quite get it.
So there's two, I mean, and correct me if I get this wrong. So there's two like pieces of his work. One is assembling the zombie from body parts, which is actually, it seems to interest him less.
Yes.
I think. So the real thing is he's setting up this central repository where he can kind of upload the brains of the world's smartest people and have all of their memories and knowledge accessible to us and transferable from that database into a receptacle brain.
Yes.
Which, so... That's kind of a lofty, interesting goal.
It's kind of like immortality in a way.
It is.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, he's kind of talking about something like in the digital age, he might be trying to, digitize your brain or consciousness and put it into the cloud or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah. So,
but my question is, which I don't know the answer, when you access these memories from these famous people, do they retain them or does it kill them? Because his process for doing stuff is kind of destructive.
I think grabbing it's fatal. Dead bodies. Yeah.
You know, and I think the idea would, I mean, so I don't think he's a murderous psychopath exactly. I think the idea is, you know, that when you die, your brain would be donated into this repository. And, you know, the dream of it is if you have this like blank receptacle, this astro zombie, and you need it to suddenly know everything about whatever geology,
right?
You could beam that information into its brain and you would have the world's smartest geologist.
Andy,
so, I don't know. I thought that was kind of cool.
That's so aspirational. I'm going to go with it, but I would like to say the one line, and this again, this I wanted to choose this clip, but there were like seven clips in the exposition scene, so I had to choose. At one point, the boss says, they say sort of what was wrong with DeMarco, and he says, when he was conducting experiments, he didn't know the difference between an Air Force officer and a cadaver. So what I get is the sense that DeMarco's not like a cackling madman. What he is he's very focused on accomplishing his goal. And he's a psychopath. He's a sociopath in the sense that, like, people don't matter to him.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
But he doesn't, like, he's not grinning and drooling. He seems like a technician who's just working through a problem. You know what I mean?
And unlike some of our villains, he's not trying to create something that is, like, over the top evil.
Right.
Like the end goal, you know, this, I think this would be the end justifies the means type of situation.
Yeah. He sounds like a less charming version of the doctor in Dr. Blood's Coffin, right? Who's just,
yes,
I can advance humanity with my research and nobody's going to stop me. He's just sort of grinding away at this. Now, there's a couple of other things I want to bring up about this scene. And then we can start moving faster, right? Because we've got all the parties involved. In fact, I don't have another clip for like an hour. So, okay. Like, you know, but so first of all, the sound effects sound just like the Starship Enterprise, right? Like the original. Yes. Yeah. There's this prolonged scene where Francho has a blood exchanger that will come up again. I have no idea. I think it's just to show blood and be gross, right?
I think so, yes.
And well, then, no, they talk about that they replace blood.
They do, but they don't say why. And then, Coleman, what with.
They do in the beginning in the CIA office. They talk about that.
Oh, okay. All right. And the last thing I'll say is I bet the actor playing Francho regretted his choice to sort of have one eye half closed for the entire film. Yes. It looks really uncomfortable.
You should take a moment and describe Francho.
So Francho, he's wearing like a Mexican themed vest. He's hunched over. He's got the greasiest black curly hair and a scraggly beard. And he's sort of hunched back and looking at people sideways. And one of his eyes is half closed. And I do not believe he speaks in the whole movie.
No, he hasn't.
He looks literally like a grease ball. So it's hard. I can't think of another word.
Clearly, he's Igor too. Clearly, that's what they're
going for. Yeah, he's all Igor all the time. Yeah. Later in the film, and I'll mention it now in case I forget it, he just brings into the lab like a struggling woman in a bikini and like is going to do experiments on her. And what is made clear is that like that has nothing to do with what Dr. DeMarco's doing. It was like hobby time for Francho.
And what does DeMarco say?
He's like, I have a clip of it later, but he says, we don't have time for your experiments. Come over here.
Yeah, he doesn't say don't do it. He just says
right,
not now.
Exactly. Exactly.
So, guys, this seems as good a time as any to bring up something that's been on my mind for quite a few episodes.
Yeah.
You guys pronounce it Igor. I always thought it was Igor.
Oh, I guess you're right. What do they say? What do they say? I think.
All right, here's what
I think the canonical one is. What do they say in
Frankenstein?
Young Frankenstein, because that's what I think is canonical. Igor or Igor?
You're right. Young Frankenstein, they go Igor rather than Igor.
That's probably why, because
I was not allowed to watch that movie as a kid, so I never, you know, got that pronunciation.
Like, I do not dislike Mel Brooks movies, but this is, in my mind, sorry about the tangent, but head and shoulders his greatest movie. Like, it is such a good satire of these old Frankenstein-style movies, and it is so funny, and is all of these actors at their absolute funniest, like... It's just a perfect funny movie. So
okay, I need to
see
it. Yeah,
you should watch it. I'm overselling it, but Gene Hackman's in it in a comedic role. He plays the blind man from the Frankenstein story.
And the original Frankenstein lab equipment from the original movie is in it.
Yes. Yeah. And Peter Boyle is the monster. He's amazing.
Madeline Kahn.
Terry Garr is hilarious.
Hey guys,
yeah,
you need to stop fantasizing about movies you'd rather be watching.
You captured me. Okay, all right, let's move on. Okay, so those are all the folks, right? And we're gonna start moving around. I'm just gonna sort of move through, and you stop me,
if there's anything.
So the next scene is we get Satana in a revealing outfit, sitting on the couch, smoking a cigarette, listening to the tape. And we find out what the tape is. The tape is John Carradine giving a lecture about this process he's inventing. And while she's doing this, I'm sorry, I do have another digression here. While she's doing this, she looks at a fake Hollywood, like a fake newspaper, like you would see in a movie. And it's called the Star Dispatch. I took a screenshot of it. And just in giant letters, it says mutilation murder across the top. And then one of the subheadlines is, and I quote, giant plane found, semicolon, all aboard safe. So I think prop newspapers and stuff work best if you don't linger on them as a director. I think it sort of shatters the illusion. So anyway, sorry, I couldn't resist.
Oh, that's good.
Okay, so she's got that. Her thugs come back, and now the CIA have these two new characters, but they're just with the CIA, and they're like listening in on Satana and trying to find out where she is. So it's very old-fashioned tech, but kind of cool. They plugged into like the phone switchboard in the parking garage, and they're like trying to figure out where she is, which they do, and they've got some guy trying to listen in, and then they capture this guy and they kill him. Oh no, that's a little later.
I mean, you can cover it now because this is sort of a subplot that goes on for a while, that the CIA are track down Satana.
Yeah, so the CIA is trying to track her down. She's got the tape. She's trying to find DeMarco. And then we cut to the CIA people we knew before and their girlfriends who also work in the good guy lab. I'm going to refer to them as DeMarco's lab and the good guy lab. So it's a good guy lab. And Wendell Corey, whose name I can't remember again. No, not Wendell Corey. The other guy. The guy who looks like JFK. Porter. Agent Porter. His girlfriend works there. And they go to essentially a strip club where they show the whole dance of a naked woman covered in body paint. And that's a 3-minute scene. So, yes. Right.
What a romantic date night.
Yes. And then we cut back. Oh, and during her dance, Andy, I pointed this out to you. What do you have in here? Voodoo drums. Uh-oh. Just for you.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Other things in this scene were distracting me.
Yes. So they make some sex jokes. It's basically, it's the video nasty part of the movie. So now the group is listening in, the villains catch them, and Satana tortures. This is another clip I thought of clipping that I chose not to. This scene is eternal, this sequence. Like,
yes,
like
all scenes are eternal in this film.
In this movie. One of the clip I didn't pull is Satana saying, kill him, and the Russian guy saying, why? And she says, I told you to kill him. And she pulls out her silenced revolver and shoots him 3 times and then shoots him again when he's down. And she's like, don't ever disobey me again. So we get a little bit more of the dynamic there, which is kind of delightful.
I appreciated. I mean, I imagine she's supposed to be a pretty good shot.
Yes.
But she spins around and fires 3 times at someone who is standing right next to her 2 inches. So I guess it's good that she wasn't off by a couple of inches. So
there's this cat and mouse game where they're trying to catch the other guy who was listening in, and they kill him in a swimming pool. Anyway, we go back to the lab. That's
good guy or bad guy?
We go back to DeMarco's lab. So technically, okay. Bad guy. Just for a minute, there's more tinkering and experimenting. This is when Franchot brings in the struggling woman she's like strapped to a inverted table, like a Frankenstein inverted table, struggling. We don't know anything about it. She's just going to hang out and be semi-naked for the rest of the movie. We don't find out who she is or if she escapes or whatever. We just check in with her periodically, unless I miss something.
This is also one of the situations where, so she's struggling and trying to escape. But like watching her struggle, she's not restrained very securely.
No, she's
and it's kind of like, lady, if you would just lift your foot by like 6 inches, you could just get off of that table.
Exactly. Yes. And so I put questions here, like, where did they capture this woman? Why is she strapped to a table? And I ultimately did not get any answers here. So
you did not.
So then,
I mean, we ultimately sort of learned that it's Franchot's side project.
His side hustle. Yeah. Then we go to the good guy lab. And they hatch this plan. So what has happened is that the other lab assistant, there's two female lab assistants, and one of them was murdered
and Janine.
Lynn and Janine. So Lynn, who not coincidentally is the less good looking one, is murdered by an astro zombie in the lab. I don't know why, but the astro zombie murders her.
Do you genuinely not know why? Or because that is explained.
Why? Tell me.
Because, I mean, not that anyone cares about spoilers here, but
right.
Because the astro zombie's brain is the brain of a criminal who was in that hospital when he died.
Okay.
And he's returning to that lab to kill the people that he remembers from when he was in the hospital. I mean, it doesn't
including
make sense.
Janine. Janine's one of the people who knew the criminal.
Okay, I missed that. All right.
Did you notice for some reason Lynn's shirt comes off while she's being stabbed by the astro zombie? Yeah.
Again, this is where we are in culture. I don't think
it comes off. It's ripped.
Yes.
Yeah, that's right.
So after she's murdered, then they come up with this plan to capture the killer.
Now listen, my dear. We're convinced that Dr. DeMarco has created an astro man with a defective brain. Now, if it's the brain of the man you've just described, it would explain why he returned to the lab.
And murdered Lynn.
Do you mean he was looking for me?
Possibly.
We feel he'll attempt to return to the lab if he has a reason.
I see. Oh, you mean you want me to act as bait?
So yes, they must have explained right before this clip the what you just said, Andy.
It was very confusing.
Yes. However, I will say that's a sample of the acting in this film for y'all. And if you think being able to see it, overhear it would enhance it at all, the answer is it would not. So, yeah.
Yes.
Now, I just want to also point out that the last clip I played was 25 minutes into the movie. Everything I just said, like that ran through in the last 5-7 minutes, was 35 minutes of the movie. That clip I just played is an hour into the movie. So there's this sort of interminable act two where nothing happens.
Can we talk about their plan to stake out the lab?
Yeah.
So
yeah, let's talk about that, Annie. So we just saw two movies ago in The Deadly Organ what a bad idea it is to have your girlfriend act as bait twice in that movie. And here it's going to be a bad idea again.
It's even worse when... So. Here is their plan. She is inside the lab and their genius plan is to go outside. The footage makes it look like they're out in the desert.
Yeah.
They go way outside, like across the street.
But
like,
Andy,
what are they going to,
but they say though, Andy said, they tell her it's okay. We're going to be just on the other side of this door. And then they cut to them, like you said, across the street, across the field.
Yeah, I know. Why not hit the bar while you're waiting?
What are they going to do? They're going to hear a scream, and then they'll have to take 2 minutes to run over to the building. Anyway,
nothing happens. There's an attempt at an artful scene which doesn't work, where there's like a beating heart sound, and they do the only quick cuts in the movie where they try to create tension. One of the quote unquote scary things in this lab is they have the. This is another thing from the late 60s, an invisible man, which is like a little doll sized skeleton with like a clear plastic body around it. I think you could put like organs and stuff in there, too. And anyway, it's absolutely silly, but nothing happens. So.
And nothing happens. I mean, you have to watch nothing happen.
You have to watch nothing happen. Right. And then her boyfriend, who is Dr. Porter, picks her up in his 1962 Thunderbird, and they, he drives her home, right? And he's going to come up for a drink, and they go in, and the lights are out. So they're like, huh, well, you stay here, Janine, and I'll go far away and check the fuse box outside. What do you think's going to happen to Janine?
Well, first she gets undressed.
Of course, yes.
But.
Duh.
But secondly, the astro zombie that is hiding in her house jumps out at her.
Yes. And she screams. She has a terrifying scream. This is interesting to me, actually. The women that scream in this movie, at some point in the 80s, we're going to get the concept of the scream queen, right? We're already sort of getting it, but it's this high-pitched, terrified scream. But what it is not is like super emotional. Like her screams here are like, oh God, no. Like it's really kind of upsetting, actually.
Yeah. Yeah. Agreed. Yeah. This is kind of an intense, uncomfortable scene to
yes.
watch.
Yes. Anyway, Dr. Porter manages to get up there just in time. The astro zombie Mr. Zombie hits him, and then like the closet door, like it's the most awkward exit for the Astro Zombie. Like the closet door like falls out of the frame and lands on him, and he's like, oh, like he stumbles out. It's amazing. However, Dr. Porter calls Holdman and says,
"Holdman, I'm at Janine's apartment. The Astro Man tried to attack her. Now look, I knocked off what might be his power source. It looked like a storyteller or something. I don't know. No, no, no. He got away. Look, he grabbed my flashlight, shined it on what looks like photocells stuck in his forehead. Now look, if Petrovich is right, he's got to head back to DeMarco's lab. Can you get Chuck to converge all available vehicles in the area? We're bound to pick up his trail somewhere. Right. And please call me back."
All right, Andy. So
I just learned something. I just learned why, for the rest of this movie, the Astro Zombie is walking around holding a flashlight up against its head.
Yes.
I didn't understand.
These are solar-powered zombies, Andy.
These are solar-powered zombies. Actually, and I think Dr. DeMarco explained that to us, like, in one of the scenes. Like,
there was this interminable discussion about, like, about solar power or something. But, I mean, it's just impossible to understand what they're saying.
Absolutely. So we're rushing towards the end here.
Oh, there's something. It's not that you missed it, but the movie missed it. Yeah.
We're stumbling. We're shambling towards the end.
We hear later that when Lynn was murdered by the Astro Zombie, we heard at that point that it shrugged shrugged off gunshots from the police.
That's right.
Which means that this thing like evaded the police somehow. Like, does this seem like something that could subtly make an escape?
Yeah, it's been sneaking into people's houses, but I think once it's out in the open, it's pretty easy to spot, especially now that it's holding a flashlight to its forehead like some bizarre zombie unicorn. Like, yeah.
I really did not understand what that was, and I'm pleased that I learned.
Yeah, okay. So then we get this scene where the Russian guy betrays the other two, and Juan is there, and anyway, they finally get to, now when I say they, I mean everybody converges on Dr. DeMarco's lab.
Yes.
But the first group to get there is Satana's evil group, minus the Russian guy. It's just her and Juan, because he tried to betray them for some reason I don't understand, and they killed him, and now they're there. And she finally meets Dr. DeMarco, who... It's just such a bizarre betrayal. I actually think it works for John Carradine. He's just acts surprised. Like I'm just here working away. What of all you want? Like,
yeah,
this is, you know, anyway, but she says, but they have this exchange, which I think explains why the first Astro Zombie is running around killing people. Andy, I promised this to you, and here it is. So here's our last clip of the show.
"We are aware of your experiments, Doctor. We know that you have succeeded in creating an Astro Zombie."
"How did you know that?"
"The recent murders, the news description of the suspect, and a tape of your lecture at the Astro Science Conference."
"Yes, he's the only complete astro mobilization I've been able to effect to date. Unfortunately, however, not totally successful. The only brain available to me at the time was that of a psychopathic killer. But I have prepared a new Astro Man."
So there you go, Andy.
Okay.
He knew it was a psychopathic killer when he created the Astro Man.
What do you think these actors thought when they saw the script? When the director was like, these are your lines for the scene.
Well, so this is the thing about John Carradine. Like, at no point does he seem ironic. Like, he's been in the grapes of wrath. Like, he's worked with the giants. Like, he's seen it all. And he just says his lines. Like, I don't know that he's putting on a particularly unique or effective character, but he delivers his lines like a pro, as dumb as they are. It made me think of is early on when Star Trek The Next Generation maybe wasn't the best. It became my favorite Trek, but some of the early episodes were a little rough. And just poor Patrick Stewart going through some of the dialogue, I was like, whoa, that is good acting, because you are selling some nonsense right there. And I feel like this is the exact same kind of thing.
Totally.
Yeah. There's a fight. The new Astro Man arrives. The Wendell Corey, the detective, arrived. He rides a station wagon, a 1962 Ford Falcon Squire. And I love, first of all, Brad, did you recognize where DeMarco's lab actually is? Because it looks like it's just in some Los Angeles neighborhood, like in the suburbs. Like,
yeah.
Yeah, I don't know where it is. I think the exterior part of it was Peter Falk's house.
Okay. All right. Okay.
But some of it looks like it was at apartment building too. So I'm not sure which is which.
I don't want to go on a digression here. I was just telling somebody about my favorite performance of Peter Falk's, and I will mention it again once we get through this movie, just so I can spit it out. But anyway, okay. So now there's a couple of army men here, just like two. And the Astro Man escapes, and he's got like a giant sword now, and he cuts.
It's like a machete.
Yeah, he's like Jason. You're right. He's the more we get into this, the more he's like Jason to me. He literally decapitates a guy. Like I think. Just
so we see a head rolling, with a bloody stump flop on the floor.
Yes,
our second one we've seen in zombie films.
That's right.
That's right.
After Plague of Zombies.
After the Plague of the Zombies.
The Plague of the Zombies.
And then the other Astro Man grabs Satana and shoves her like into the breaker box, and they both get electrocuted. And we linger a long time on Satana getting electrocuted. The other Astro Man dies. And then that's the end of the movie?
Is it that easy to get electrocuted by your breaker box?
I don't believe so.
Because in Zombies of the Stratosphere, they defeated a villain by shoving it into a breaker box.
Well, in that one, it was like a big electrical panel in a really sophisticated lab. This is like the breaker box in your house. Like, slightly less dramatic. Okay.
I mean, I'm asking semi-seriously because now I'm going to be a little nervous.
Yeah,
next time
you're
to
fine.
Flip us.
Don't worry about it.
All right.
Anyway, that's the end, Andy. Did I miss it? Oh, closing credits. It says the end, and all the robots that were walking around in the bizarre intro credit sequence, they just fall over. And then it's really the end of the movie. Did I miss anything that we had to cover?
You missed a lot, but like, I don't think
that's why I caveat missed, it with we
I
had
don't
to
think
cover.
You missed anything that you should have brought up. So
yes.
All right, John, in the Astro Zombies, is there a hero party?
There is a hero party. It's these CIA guys, Dr. Porter and Wendell Corey, whatever his name is, and Janine. And so there is a hero party.
How many of them survive? How do they do?
They struggle a little bit, but the ones who die are sort of secondary characters that gets introduced later. So Lynn dies and the two guys eavesdropping on Satana die. And the woman in the beginning dies, but three at least. And if we count the woman at the beginning, she's just part of the kill count. She's not part of the hero party, but
yeah, it really truly is never explained why she got killed. The others, there's a tenuous reason.
No, it's just to show the Astro Zombies crazy, to show some salacious blood, and to have a well-endowed woman get murdered by somebody. So
what kind of zombie are we dealing with in this movie?
All right. So we're dealing with an intentionally created scientific zombie that has gone awry, because they call it the Astro Man, but once it starts killing stuff, they really call it the Astro Zombie. So that's how they do it. It's created. It's like a NASA project, basically.
Yeah. And how fast is it? Subhuman, normal human, or super fast?
It's normal human, but it's stronger and indestructible, but it's also a psychopathic killer. So
how is it destroyed or killed?
In this case, you have to remove its power source. So in that sense, it feels like the creature with the atom brain, right? That had their atomic power sources. In fact, that was one of those electrical cabinet killings. That's a parallel I hadn't realized until now, but it's that kind of thing. They're trying to make a rechargeable battery so that can go forever, but he takes it off of it and that kills it. Or you can electrocute it, or it can electrocute itself through the body of another person in your breaker box.
It can also be shut down from the lab.
Oh, right.
At one point, it's too confusing to explain why, but John Carradine switches off one of the zombies.
That's right.
Okay. Let's see. Is there a zombie horde in this movie?
No. There's two Astro Zombies.
Can the zombies return to being human?
I sure hope not. No, I don't believe so.
And so, thinking about the portrayal of zombies in this movie, are there any new strains or zombie movie firsts about the zombies?
I think what feels like the firsts here are like the slasher style, right?
Yeah.
Of the zombies. They're less zombie-like. They're murderous, but not in the ways we expect zombies to be. It's almost like a regular person with a, you know?
It is, yes. It is a regular person. At one point, the problem that the evil scientist has is he's trying to, when he puts a brain in these Astro Zombies,
he's trying to strip everything except it, like all, he's trying to strip out all emotion from them. So it is, they are in a sense real people, just with a brain that's had some chunk of their personality deleted.
Yeah, so they're zombies that have been converted into zombies using this scientific process.
I had two firsts for you. I had the first solar-powered zombies.
Fair.
And then more along the lines for you and your historical context, this is the first time we've had the CIA involved. In the past, the government has been the military. But
yes,
now we're working into the spy world.
Or in Zombies of the Stratosphere, they don't even say who it is, or they make up some department. So you're right. Interesting.
Okay.
That is right, interesting, so, actually, Andy, in terms of 1968 and the CIA. We'll have to discuss that later, though.
It is. There's more than a little bit of spy movie to this.
Yes. Yeah. Okay.
So, hey, John, at the beginning of this podcast, you identified four pillars of the zombie film. Let's find out how many of them can be found in the Astro Zombies.
Yes.
John, is there an apocalypse in this movie?
Negative. No apocalypse.
Is there contagion in this movie?
Nope.
Are there tough moral choices?
I really don't think so. Like, the only one you could argue is Dr. DeMarco, but he doesn't have any morals.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, that's designed to be, like, do we kill this person so we can live? Or, you know, that's what we were looking for here, and it's just not here, I don't think.
Yeah, agreed. And lastly, are there loved ones turning against you in this movie?
No, because we don't even know who the zombies were before they became zombies, so...
Yeah.
Unless you count the Russian guy turning on Satana as a loved one turning against you. But
I mean, the only people that turn are thugs that try to betray you, and then Satana kills you.
Yes. Yeah. All right.
You know, I didn't ask earlier, John, but is the world threatened?
In theory, yes, but not really. It's more like a James Bond style plot where the world may be threatened, but nobody will ever find out about it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And like, I mean, the body count is three, you know, scale is fairly small.
All right. Well, now it's my turn. So back in our 1960s episode, you set forward some themes you thought we would see in our 1960s movies. So let's get into them. Is there an increase in violence or grittiness in this film?
And we also add sexuality to this question.
Yes.
And the answer to that is definitely yes.
For sure.
It's not, this movie doesn't have the highest kill count. And I don't know if its deaths are necessarily the most brutal we've seen. However, they have a sort of slasher intensity to them.
Yeah, they're trying to disturb sort of very explicitly.
Yeah, they're kind of nasty. Part of that is we have just longer drawn out deaths where people are screaming rather than, you know, stabbed once in the back and they keel over.
Yes.
And the sexualization of the violence is really on center stage here and adds to the uncomfortableness of it.
Yeah, absolutely. How about questioning authority here?
I don't think that is a big theme of this movie. Feel free to correct me. It is the authorities who, you know, kind of come in and save the day here. It's the CIA that got onto this mad scientist plot, and this movie is about them successfully taking him down. So, and none of the characters here are of the sort of young rebellious sort, I don't think. These are young professionals with jobs, you know.
Yeah, they remind me of the couple from Valley of the Zombies, right, that are engaged and working in the lab together and all
exactly,
that stuff.
Exactly, yeah.
The only case you can make is DeMarco sort of pursuing his own agenda, you know, in a rebellious way. But again, he works for the authorities. I don't know. He's not. I think with this question, you meant our heroes would be people who questioned authority, and that's
generally speaking. So I don't see a lot of it.
Focus on a hero's inner life or personalized horror?
I don't think so. What do you think about this one?
I don't think that's here. But you know, what's funny is that the ultimate example of this is playing across the street in another theater, Rosemary's Baby.
Oh, you know, totally.
This is, I think, one of the films that inspired this theme of yours. You know, and it ain't here.
Yeah.
How about fear, crime, societal chaos, and anarchy? We do have a woman getting murdered in her suburban garage.
Yeah, I was going to say no, but then I was thinking, like, the movie opens with a seemingly randomly selected woman being followed to her house and brutally murdered, which does feel like, I mean, it does feel like 1960s California crime scare, right?
Yeah, there was not a lot, but there were definitely significant crime scares like this. And I think it would have been on people's minds.
And, you know, there is a murder scene. That murder scene in the beginning takes place in her garage. Mm-hmm. Like, it's a very, it should be a safe place, right?
Yeah.
And when the Astro Zombie attacks Janine later, it's in her house, in her bedroom.
Yep.
I don't think we see a ton of zombies getting into people's houses yet.
Not yet.
So, okay. So you have convinced me, and I've talked myself into saying, yes, this movie has themes of fear of crime and societal chaos.
All right. How about a sense of looming apocalypse and psychological stress?
I don't really think so. The tenuous connection here is that, you know, there are some Cold War superpower scares here, mm-hmm. I think, in the background.
Yeah.
It's suggested that Satana and these other parties are working for rival governments that would probably, you know, in the world of this movie, threaten the survival of the free world if they got this technology. However, I didn't really think that was a very strong theme.
Yeah, the CIA boss mentions it falling into somebody else's hands, but it's not stressed in any way.
Yeah.
And last one, how about horrors without solutions or a lack of clear villains to defeat?
I don't think so. I think this one, this situation, so this movie is interesting in that we have not had very many movies. I can't think of any off the top of my head that had multiple villain factions.
Right.
So that is kind of interesting.
Yeah. So it's complex, right? And DeMarco isn't a good guy either.
Right.
So the whole situation is complex. So maybe, I don't know. I don't think it's that.
Yeah. Idea. So, I mean, it is a more interesting setup.
Right.
Because you have a mad scientist who is one type of villain. And then you have this other group of spies who are another type of villain. But at the end of the day, they are villains, and the problems they create can be solved by killing them, which is what happens.
Right. All right, Andy, back to you to bring us home.
You bet. John, would you and I survive in the zombie world of the Astro Zombies?
Yeah. No, I would die of boredom. No, it's, I don't know. If I got caught up in this, I could see the thing is, because of where we are culturally, Astro Zombies currently are only killing women.
Yeah.
So, you know, they do try to kill some other people, but they cut the head off an army man.
Yeah, but it wasn't a very convincing beheading.
No, it was not. So I think I would survive. Yeah.
Yeah. The thing that makes me hesitate is the Jason-ness of the
Astro
Zombie.
That's true. He does that have sort of that relentless.
Yeah.
And he even has a machete later.
Yeah. If I seriously wonder if there's a connection between this movie and
I had the same thought, you know, actually. Yeah.
First of all, what is the machete doing in that lab? Anyway. But you know, if this thing were loose in your suburban neighborhood, John, I don't know. I don't know if I would survive if this thing were out to get me.
No, so. Probably not. Okay, I'll change my answer. I'll say no. It could get me.
Well, I'm not trying to convince you. I'm just sharing my take.
All right.
And you are notoriously you're tougher to take down, I think, than me. So
okay, I'm taller,
John,
anyway.
Is The Astro Zombies a zombie movie, or is it a movie with zombies?
I think it's a movie with zombies, because the zombie is like the Astro Zombie is like almost a third party, right? It's really a plot about stealing state secrets. There just happens to be a zombie involved, you know.
It also has a whole foot in the sort of golem subgenre of horror. So.
Yeah.
Yeah, agreed. And John, lastly, do you recommend this movie, firstly, just generally as a good film that people should seek out and watch? And secondly, do you think that this has special interest for our zombie-loving listeners?
So I'm going to say no to the first one, pretty clearly. It's just too slow and incompetent a movie. But I'm going to say yes to the latter and with this context. If you are really doing this dive with us where you want to see this, it's not a... You know, there's some good zombie stuff in here, but it's got proto-slasher stuff in it, and it really does dive into the 60s vibe in a way that we've been anticipating all along but only getting recently. So as a student of this, I would say, yes, you should watch it. But as a regular person, I don't see the value.
I think I'll agree. Definitely no on if you're a normie, should you watch this. I'll give it a tentative, a soft yes if you're a zombie fan. I do think this movie's negatives are very overwhelming.
Yes.
And yeah, but you are right. The slasher, a zombie as a slasher is kind of interesting.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Agreed. All right.
All right. Well, it's time for the scariest part of this episode. And that is when Brad reveals to me and John, first, how many more movies we have to get through before we get to Night of the Living Dead. And secondly, what movie we're watching next.
Well, for our next film, I couldn't find a trailer with dialogue, but I did find clips that had music. So I will play the music from the film as you view the poster for the first time. So here we go.
All right.
Okay.
Whoa, Dr. Satan y la Magica Negra. Is that Dr. Satan, the Black Magician? Is that what that means?
Dr. Satan and the Black Magic?
I think Andy's right.
Okay.
Okay.
All right.
John, you want to describe what we see here?
So the poster has photos. There's a photo in the upper left-hand corner of a red person with horns. Presumably that's Dr. Satan. And then there's some women in miniskirts and tight-fitting sweaters in the bottom left. It is filmed in Eastman color, and it stars a bunch of people whose names I do not recognize. Though there is somebody named Joaquin, it's not the one we all know.
Yeah, so what country is this?
Yeah, where's this from?
It's from Mexico.
Okay.
Well, we've had good luck with Mexican horror.
We have. Now, is this our last film before we watch Night of the Living Dead?
So Dr. Satan and the Black Magic is the last film we are going to watch before Night of the Living Dead. So our countdown is one movie and then Night of the Living
Dead.
And
then it's our Super Bowl, Night of the Living Dead. It's our UN, our Super Bowl, our whatever, presidential debate, whatever you're into. So we're ready. I'm excited. We've been doing a lot of prep for that. I don't want to dismiss Dr. Satan and the Black Magic. We're going to give it a good old try. Next episode, but episode after that, Night of the Living Dead. So we've got this big movie coming up. We'd love to hear your thoughts, questions, anything you have. You can email us at zombiestrainspodcast@gmail.com. We're also on Instagram under zombiestrains and Facebook. So reach out on one of those platforms or send us an email. We'd love to hear from you. And without further ado, we'll see you next time on Zombie Strains. You've been listening to Zombie Strains. We'll be back next episode to talk about another zombie movie. If you enjoyed our podcast, please take a moment to rate us in your podcast app of choice. Tell a friend. Follow us on Instagram at Zombie Strains. All of this helps like-minded people find the show. See you next time.